It's all fun and games until someone pops a vocal cord trying to imitate Nathan Queen on the Fish Golf Broadcast. All right, in arguably worse environmental conditions than interviewing AJ Risley in a Waffle House, I am on hole 18, the porch of the Sap House at Maple Hill, along with Casey White. Casey, what you thinking about?
I'm a little chilly right now, but I'm just happy to be at Maple Hill for the weekend of the MVP Open.
I think Fireball is supposed to warm you up.
Yep, it certainly is, and it's doing its job.
So I have a premise, and this is a very long-standing premise, that when somebody offers me Fireball, I consider it a punishment. Like, what did I do wrong?
Fair enough.
This thing tastes bad, and I don't like it.
I'm usually in your shoes as well, and I've always been like a decline. But right now it's a little chilly, so I just felt like it was necessary for the group.
Okay, and I guess you just don't have enough meat on your bones, so you're gonna flee from Massachusetts at the first sign of cold weather.
No, I'm not. I'm very happy in Massachusetts, and I just deal with the cold weather. I would just say that I don't know. I get cold easy. Doesn't mean that I'm like afraid of it though.
I don't know. I think we both have our own narratives here, and I'll stick with mine. So who are some players that you know to be very scared of cold? Like Matty O just like bundles
okay,
up.
Okay, Matty O. I guess my immediate brain went to like my close friends, Terry Roethlisberger.
Sure. That guy's been dodging all the weather by being in Jacksonville for...
Started living in Jacksonville because he used to live in Minnesota, and I will argue that Minnesota is probably the worst state in the continental 48 to play disc golf in the winter.
I hoped you were just going to end that sentence.
No, I like Minnesota. Just like the thing that sucks is like if something is so good, it cannot be like great on the flip side of the coin. So that's why like Minnesota disc golf in the summer is like one of my favorite places to play in the summer, but the winters are so bad that it balances out.
It kind of seems to be the same with Wisconsin and Michigan, where like it's almost, maybe you could extend this to Finland too, where the badness of the winter means that everybody is so excited to recreate during the better
seasons
for that.
Absolutely. I mean, Massachusetts, it really depends on what we get. Like, we can get nothing, and we can get absolutely, like, slaughtered.
Iced in for 2 weeks at a time. Like,
So we play Team Challenge, one match per month. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't snow all month, and then right before your Team Challenge match, it'll snow a foot. And it's a roll of the dice. Where Minnesota and Wisconsin and Michigan, I feel like they can just, like, guarantee themselves snow. And it just piles up.
Sure. Can we do a little compare and contrast here?
Yeah.
Let's say you've got a team challenge match, and who's your home team?
Buffumville.
Okay, so you're with Buffumville, and how many people are in the regular rotation to go on a team challenge match?
24, including two girls. So it's 22 men, two girls, minimum two girls.
Right.
You can have more. We have three available on our team.
And if the weather is, you know, iffy leading up to the event, how many of those people are, you know, kind of on the fence?
Nobody's on the fence, but we're all on the fence of preparation and practice.
Yeah.
So we'll probably just say, let's just show up Saturday and bring our best, because why spend hours practicing in the snow and cold? And
okay, but basically, you're going to go 24 for 24 in terms of people showing up for this unsanctioned match where there really are no huge stakes.
I mean, everybody's held accountable. The people with kids definitely get a pass every once in a while. But we've actually recently kind of had to cut some players from the team because of lingering injury. Like, that, we just can't really rely on them. But the good thing is that we're allowed roster moves. So if we have, let's say, so Matt Coble, he's been on the team for years and years, longer than I've been on the team. And, man, the guy's just unlucky with his body just injuring itself.
Uh-huh.
He was stretching at one match in the morning and injured himself, and he couldn't play that day. But the thing is about Team Challenge is you always want to gather your numbers before it matters, because if you gather your numbers and you give the team your number, if you don't show up with that number that you gave the team, then you get penalized points. So everybody holds themselves accountable, and, you know, we go out there in the conditions no matter what.
Okay. Team Challenge is such a really neat regional experience, and it's cool that it's durable. It's cool that there's, you know, like the home course identity along with the promotion and relegation. Mm-hmm. Now, the contrast part of our exercise, let's say that you and three touring pros are signed up for a tee time. You're on the spreadsheet that the Pro Tour has put out, which doesn't super lock you in, but you're supposed to go there. And there's a little pop-up rainstorm.
Yep.
No thunder and lightning,
nope.
But it's drizzling. And the temperature drops 6 degrees Fahrenheit to a reasonable...
From 70 to 64.
Correct. How many of those three other people show up for the
one? Absolutely not. Like, I did it on Wednesday. I'm guilty. I just signed up for all my tee times on Sunday and just hoped that the weather would change. And I actually had like a tee time that overlapped with like an MVP feature card or something
right.
like that. And Phil was like, hey, we have to move your tee time. I'm like, oh, don't worry. I'm not going to be there. But I have to say that was maybe a second time offense, but I think that was my first offense of signing up for a tee time and no showing it.
Yeah, for sure. Occasionally there will be something where like, sorry, traffic was just mm-hmm. bad. I'm
yep.
15 minutes
yep.
late. But yeah, at this point it feels like you sign up for your tee time and you'll probably be there.
It's like plus or minus 15 minutes
yeah.
for everybody. Like you might show up earlier and nobody's on the tee, so you just start chucking. But like the other day we scheduled ourselves for a 3 p.m. tee time. And because we were supposed to do an Ace Run challenge with Ace Run Pro, figured we'd get lunch afterwards. Well, Raven Newsom aced on the first try. First throw of the entire challenge, he aced hole 8 from the diamond pad.
Mm-hmm.
And our day was over. So we just went straight to hole 1 because we were planning on being there for like an hour, then get lunch, and then come back. And our 3 p.m. tee time quickly turned into 12:30. And Luke Sampson walked up to the tee pad as we were just standing there. And he's like, oh, are you guys 12:30? I'm like, no, dude, we don't have a tee time. You go ahead.
And I think at least among the regular touring players, there's the expectation of you can jump on whenever, but whoever has that tee time has the priority.
Yeah, for sure. And like the way that I see it is I end up with players all the time. Like I'll sign up for their tee time, but they chose to go 30 minutes earlier just mm-hmm. for no good reason. And now I'm playing by myself, which I don't actually mind. But like, I'm just like, okay, you know, it's time to tee off. I'm not going to wait around for them because I just happened to put my name next to theirs.
Yeah.
It's not like I texted them and said, hey, like, do you mind?
And I guess in a way, there are pluses and minuses to practicing with other people.
Absolutely.
You can see more shots. You're less likely to lose a disc since you got more eyes on it. But sometimes it can put bad ideas in your head about how to plan and prepare for a course.
Absolutely. I find myself in certain scenarios, my regular practice group, which I'm just going to say across the entire tour, like it certain weeks, my certain friends aren't there or whatever, like they skip certain events or I skip certain events. But my regular practice group is Trevin Crowe, Marky Chapp, and Kyle Klein.
Sure.
And we have a good mix. Trevin's pretty forehand dominant. Kyle is one of the best players in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Marky Chapp is just barely, like, I don't know, not there with the consistency, I would say. And it's like an interesting mix because I get to see Trevin slaying forehands and I can see what's possible if I were to choose forehand.
Right.
I can see what the best in the world are choosing to throw, which is what Kyle's doing. And then I can also, like, see what Marky Chapp's doing. Maybe it's a safe play. And I'm like, oh, maybe that's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
And like, that's not to slander Marky Chapp.
No.
Although we could spend an awful lot of time
on
that.
We sure could.
Yeah. Like, he's 1,000 rated. He knows
Absolutely.
What he's doing out
yeah.
there. And I guess that must have been interesting when Kyle was dealing with some injuries and
mm-hmm.
was pretty much relegated to throwing only forehands.
Yep.
You've had your style shift pretty considerably, and you can refer back to one of the very early episodes of the Fish Golf broadcast
yep.
for a description of that. But you came up being very forehand dominant and now have shifted to backhand. And part of the reason I wanted to have you back on was to talk about your shifting experiences at the Smuggler's Notch resort courses,
mm-hmm.
Fox Run Meadows and Brewster Ridge.
Yep. I mean, I can tell you right now, there's a couple holes on Brewster Ridge that I used to kind of be lost because my backhand just wasn't good enough, or like it was right in between slots that I couldn't figure out what the perfect distance was, and I have settled on standstill backhand.
Okay.
And the hole I think of in particular is hole nine. Hole nine, I used to throw a rock on it. Now I don't have a rock in my bag. My mid-range is on tour, don't get used as often as they used to when I would just stick around New England all year.
Yeah.
So I go up to that hole, and I used to try and throw like a down-tempo FD. But the down-tempo, it would just, I don't know, just feel wrong sometimes. Like it's like a significant difference between my usual quick and snappy full-power run-up. And standstill allows me to fully commit, and that's what I like about it. And the way that I treat Brewster Ridge is I plan to throw this many standstills per round. And depending on how they fall in the line, if the first one feels good, well, then I'm going to commit to the second one. And mm-hmm. I'm going standstill on that hole for sure. And actually, on round one of the World Championship, I standstill hole nine threw it bad. I misplaced my back foot. I had my hips too far open at the load, where usually I drop my left foot back more so mm-hmm. I can be turned away with my hips. Mm-hmm. And I yanked it right, but then we had the rain delay, and I was about, my next tee shot was hole 12, which I had also planned to throw standstill. And I just, I don't know, came in with the fresh mindset after the rain delay and got the birdie there. And I don't think anybody else in the tournament is throwing a standstill in hole 12 at Brewster Ridge, and the fact that I birdied it means that it was worth it.
No, there are two holes that I am throwing standstill on.
Six,
absolutely. Yep. I want to go Comet there so that I can give kind of a full swing instead of flirting with the back wall or the inside, throwing a putter or something. The other one kind of is not all the time. I will occasionally stand still hole 15. If I don't like if I don't like conditions, I will just get inbounds with a mid.
Oh, wow. And
I didn't have to do that this year.
Wow, that's like one of my favorite holes on the course to attack.
It's really cool. It's really cool.
As a righty.
Yeah, it's Brewster's very interesting to me in that all the forehand guys throw their forehand, all the backhand guys throw their backhand, and then there's a couple holes where you simply cannot do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that was your or you've kind of given the explanation of like how your game has changed and it's made you approach certain holes differently. Can you talk about Fox Run? Because you've got like a 6-year history playing Fox Run Meadows, and that used to be the course you murdered, and now not so much.
Yeah, I know. It's gotten away from me a little bit, and it's almost as if I have expanded my backhand capabilities to a greater extent, that when I used to just be a 400 consistent hyzer, and that's it, nothing fancier than that. Nowadays, I find myself looking at, a perfect example would be hole 9. Hole 9 on Fox Run, it has a boulder behind the basket, mm-hmm. OB right, OB left. Always a different wind, it feels like. You never know what you're going to get when you play that hole. And I used to just throw an overstable fairway and chip to the middle and get up and down for three on that hole and just clean my scorecard up and move on to hole 10, because hole 10 I'm looking to birdie.
Right. And every now and again, I'm sure you'd screw it up and leave your putt leave your approach short and have to settle for a four.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. And nowadays, I look at a shot like that, and I'm like, oh, I got this in the bag. And then I attack. And attacking gives me two out-of-bounds right throws.
Oops.
Yeah. And actually, no. One of them I bogeyed without out-of-bounds with a just completely botched tap-in. Ah. But I did go out-of-bounds right in the second round at Fox Run, and I made like a 100-footer for my par. And like I just like kind of shrugged my shoulders because I'm like, well, like, I should just take a par on this hole anyway. So
yeah.
That sucks.
So Fox is the rare open course where extra distance can be helpful, but sometimes it only gets you in trouble.
Yep.
So as you've added that distance, what are there any other holes where, you know, now out of bounds is in play,
mm-hmm.
or you're at a distance where it's not comfortable to throw the full swing approach?
Well, hole 12 is the one that recently got changed.
Right.
But that one used to be easy, just like throw it as hard as I can.
And, can't possibly go OB long.
Yeah, and nowadays I used to throw just like a slower speed, but now it's a par 5 and they ruined that hole. But one hole.
Interesting. Okay,
you thought they made it better. Hole 12.
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
I think that previously, for players like you and I, it was very straightforward to throw, you know, the effective distance of 425 on hyzer and put yourself in a landing zone.
Yep.
But there wasn't really a way to screw that up. So everybody was doing that because there was no way to cross in one.
Okay, fair
enough.
And
having more power didn't help a whole lot. It just made the second shot, whether you could throw a fairway and hold it straight, or if you had to flex a driver in the air. Now I feel like the second and third shots are more critical because you're having to make a golf decision about whether you're throwing to a landing zone that's often not directly in front of you. You're often pointing yourself at out of bounds.
Oh, absolutely. I'm throwing it so far left and turning it way over to get back in bounds.
Which is a cool aesthetic.
Yeah, absolutely. The way that I see it, maybe I was just underselling myself.
Okay.
Because I saw that change and I said, why am I getting a free birdie?
Huh.
And I just didn't understand because I used to have to throw as far as I could without being risky off the tee, not land on that hump. You know, there's a certain spot in the hump, in the sweet spot, where if you go too far, it's a little risky. But if you come up too short, you got that side hill footing.
Yep.
And I kind of like the challenge of that. And then it was always about the second shot, though. You could throw the best drive ever, but if you didn't execute that second shot well, which you either basically choose a late turn and you aim it down the out-of-bounds line, or you could just take like a stubborn disc, nice and flat, maybe a baby flex, and hopefully land in the circle. Where nowadays, I throw a driver as hard as I can, like I do on every single other course on the Disc Golf Pro Tour, a distance driver. And then I throw a distance driver, hyzer flip, turn over the out-of-bounds. But in my opinion, I was only complicating that shot because I don't like my long-range sidearm for like for a hyzer shot, let me say that. And I was just like, okay, and now all I have to do is get up and down from 190. If I throw it perfect, obviously, like, you know, 250-foot upshot with nothing in my way. And I felt like the two-shot par four challenged me much greater. Because even the second time around, I flexed out my shot over the out-of-bounds too much, and I crossed in bounds, and it was a chip-up par.
Right.
Where if I did that and flexed out-of-bounds on the old hole, it would be a guaranteed bogey.
So I guess your premise is that the bonus stroke relative to par makes the hole too forgiving.
I guess relative to par. Like, it would be dumb if they made it a par four just because some guys can reach it in two. Like, I agree that that should be an eagleable par five for the bigger arms. That's a perfect example for the top level distance throwers to be getting an eagle. That is, like, it's not easy, but it's specifically difficult enough that it can only reward the big distance throwers to get that extra stroke on the field. And that's where I think we've lost ourselves on certain par fives. I just felt like me as a player, it was way easier for me to birdie this year.
Okay. Well, I hope you do continue birdieing it or find an extra 125 feet.
Fair enough. I'll find it soon enough, maybe.
I'm Harry Chase, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I eat peanut butter jelly sandwiches in the bathtub.
I'm Evan Smith, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I sing.
If you like where this show is headed, stick around for part two. We'll never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads to start the show. So please support the Fish Golf Broadcast by visiting discgolfbra.com for hats and other apparel. Fish stamp discs are available at fishdiscgolf.com and daddydiscgolf.com, and you can save 10% on upperparkdiscgolf.com with the code Andrew10 on backpacks and other items. And now, more lies and outrageous claims from our guest, met with calm reason by Fish.
Taking a step backwards to the broader question, with lots of years of history playing Fox Run, like, your finish at 2018 Worlds was largely built on three really good rounds on Fox.
Yes, absolutely. I went one down and three down on Brewster Ridge.
Okay.
So, like, you know, back then, I think James Conrad shot like a 13 under on Brewster Ridge. And I was nowhere near what the best in the game were capable of doing. I was just doing my best. And as I would pride myself as a Woods player, Brewster Ridge was just like a little bit out of my league still.
Okay.
As far as what you would compare power woods versus spinny woods, mm-hmm. I didn't quite have that spin control, which I feel like I do now, or at least I'm getting there. But my sidearm got me through Rooster Ridge, and my backhand got me through Fox Run.
Okay.
And my backhand was just not good enough that it forced me to play as safe as possible. And the one round that got me ahead was round three at Worlds, and I was six down through six. And, you know, hole six is the easiest hole in the course, so once I got that one, I'm like, well, like, you just happen to get all the other ones. Like, you know, you're used to getting hole two and hole six and being two down through six, or maybe hole one as well. And three down through six was a great start. Now you're six through six, and I was just like, cash out. Just cash out. Like you are already in position, and just get yourself off this golf course. And I felt like I did. I got pars on 16, 17, 18, and 17 and 18, I laid up 35-foot putts just because I was cashing out.
Yeah.
I knew what I had. I had no reason to give up any other bogey than I did on hole 7. I went six down through six and bogeyed 7. It happens. You know what I mean? Like, hole 7's hole 7.
Yeah, everybody, and you can also tell yourself the lie, hey, I'm 5 through 7. That's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. And then I just locked it down. Like, I played for par on 8. I played for par on 9 and played for par on 16. So I was very, very satisfied with the way that I just was able to, as an 18-year-old 978 rated golfer, I played the best round I possibly could have
mm-hmm.
at the highest level.
So you as a player have evolved considerably. And last year you won the Brewster Ridge Open,
yes,
right?
Sir.
Which isn't just played on Brewster. It's played on both Fox. And there were some pretty crazy wind conditions, and you still murdered Fox, right?
Yes. So we had a pretty windy round one. I think I actually shot over par on Fox round one at Brewster Ridge Open 2022.
Okay.
And over par on Fox Run for me is unheard of. Couldn't believe it. I had only had one previous over par round on Fox Run, and it was because I triple bogeyed hole 18. And I was just like, no, Casey White does not shoot over par on Fox Run. I don't understand, but somehow I'm still on chase card. That just goes to show how tough the conditions were. And mind you, I'm the second or third highest rated player in the field. So, like, the fact right. that I'm on chase card, I'm like, come on, bro.
This is an A tier. This is not GMC.
Yes. And Brewster Ridge, it's looking like awful weather, like in the 30s with just ripping wind and never ending rain.
In June. What a health game.
In June. Yep. And, you know, no rain delay necessary because there's no thunder or lightning or anything like that. Just rain. 6.5 hour round. And I was just able to.
For context, with longer holes at Worlds, Brewster Ridge rounds were like 3 hours 15.
Yeah. 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 They went pretty smooth. There's only a couple bad spots. But we, starting at hole 8, had, I think, a 3 to 4 card backup on every hole for the rest of the course. But minus like the easier holes, which used to be like 14 and maybe like 16.
Yeah.
But like, man, it was so rough. And I was able to shoot the best round I'd ever shot in a tournament on Brewster Ridge. I shot 7 under
mm-hmm.
and it was like crazy rated. And I jumped from chase card all the way into leading the tournament. And then Fox Run, it was looking windy again. And I just looked at it as, well, I know what not to do because that's what I did in round one. And I just stayed sharp. I didn't get lazy. I didn't take shots for granted. And I just, like, I can enter a round sometimes, especially at one of those A tier, B tiers where I, like, look at my card mates and I respect them as competitors, but I just tell them, like, no, you, this isn't your day.
You got nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was one of those days. It was Harry Chase, Steve Brinster, and Marty Hendel. So mm-hmm. three very good players, like worthy competitors. And just they just each one of them showed a couple glimpses of just the wind getting the best of them.
Yeah.
And I was just like, I'm not turning off the engine. So like, good luck.
Yeah.
And I hit like a nice circle two putt on 14. And then we're coming down the stretch and I birdied 17, I believe. Or no, actually, I didn't birdie 17. I laid up on 17 just because it was windy and there was no need for me to go for my 34-footer. And I looked at my stepmom after hole 17 and I said, do I need to birdie? And she laughed. And I said, okay, well, I'm still attacking. because I don't know how to play the hole any other way other than attack it.
Pound something down there. If you go OB left, you
and live
with
I threw the best shot probably thrown on that hole all day, and then the thing got to the tree and then lifted a mile in the air and went across the parking lot into the porta potties, like
Gets
where
your
the porta potties
go.
Yeah, so I went OB left, threw my upshot to like 28 feet, and I was just kind of looking at everybody. I'm like, man, I kind of want to go for this. Just because I know I got the bag. And they're like, what are you thinking? You won the tournament. Just lay up. I'm like, well, how many am I winning by? They're like, 11. I'm like, 11? I'm like, but I can win by 11, not 10. And they're like, just lay up. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to line it up. So I line it up, and I'm just like, dude, nah, you got this. And I just chucked it under, and I immediately looked at the crowd and gave myself a double thumbs down. I was like, please boo me. Like, I'm I don't know.
So that was your most recent tournament experience before Worlds 2023.
I played Brewster Ridge Open 2023.
Again this year.
Yes.
Okay. So the like story arc I'm trying to elicit here is you have so much history on these, and like you shredded in very, very challenging conditions on Fox last year. And the Worlds conditions were favorable.
Very favorable. It's almost like I had nothing to really think about. Like, I didn't have that challenge of calculating the perfect shot. Like, it was just chuck it the way you know how to chuck it. And then next thing I know, I'm out of bounds. And, like, it's just mind-boggling. And that's where I start to drive myself crazy. It's like, you know how to play this course. Like, why are you acting like you don't know how to play this course? Not like, it's not like I'm forgetting. I know I don't forget. I just know that I'm not doing it the way that I should and can. And, you know, then you start to drive your mind through the freaking blender. You
got all this history, mm-hmm. and you're like passing these milestones of, well, damn, I was two down the last time I
yep.
played it at this point.
Yep.
And now I'm over par.
That's and it goes to show about like part of the gift and a curse of having an incredible memory. Is not only can I remember all the incredible shots and accomplishments that I've gotten, but I also remember all of the bad shots that I've ever executed
right.
on a course. And, you know, I step up to a hole like hole five, and it's like, well, don't throw it like that one time where you turned it out of bounds, but at the same time, I've parked this hole a million times. So I'm landing not in the right spot, and I'm like, well, I know how to park it. I remember the line. Why can't you do it? And then it's like, oh, man, drives yourself nuts.
Yeah, for sure. So next year, ostensibly, you will be playing Green Mountain Championships again.
Yeah.
How are you going to approach your practice rounds differently on both Fox Run and Brewster Ridge?
Brewster Ridge is becoming the course that is like back of my hand, I feel like. I throw all the shots as good as anybody else. Fox Run is almost like I need to take a step back and I need to throw for less distance, more consistency, and just play the course the way that I know how to score. And yeah, I don't know. Maybe I'll be playing hole nine for par.
Kind of simplify it,
mm-hmm.
and you might take fewer birdies, but
it's almost
bogeys.
Like just let your ego take a rest a little bit and be satisfied with not as great of a score. Like,
okay.
I used to shoot a four down on that course and go, eh. But, like, I think I need to bring myself back to the point where, like, if I shoot a five down, I should be like, all right, good round.
Like, five down is still 10-30
uh-huh.
or something.
Yep.
Do you feel like the same thing can occur at other courses you're intimately familiar with, like Maple Hill?
Yes. And I think that I am making, like, breakthroughs at Maple Hill, whereas it used to be the one course for me. Like, not like Smuggs, where I did have the pressure on myself, where Smuggs was new. When by the time I was a pro, I had never played Smuggs by then. And Maple Hill has just been where I grew up.
Right.
So when the Maple Hill Open would come around, I would have this, like, unnecessary pressure and expectations and everything like that. But I feel like my tenure at Maple Hill is longer, so I've already kind of gotten over that hump of high expectations, not meeting those expectations, getting frustrated, don't understand why. And like nowadays, like I step up to hole one's tee and I'm not nervous. I'm just kind of grateful. I'm just like, man, I'm just so like I do what I do every week of the year to be
at the MVP Open, like, and playing in the tournament.
It's becoming not just you happen to live here and got on registration. Yeah. Like, you have to earn your spot.
Oh, absolutely. And I was at a point this season where it wasn't guaranteed that I was going to get to play MVP Open. And now that I am in the event, I am the only Massachusetts, like, born and bred player in the entire event. Simon is Massachusetts, but we all know he's Germany. He's not born in Massachusetts. He just happens to live here.
Simon, you can come on and fight if you want.
I mean, the Massachusetts people claim Simon as their own, and that's great, but they would be Simon fans if he lived in New Mexico.
This is like Dusty Road.
Like,
I've been everywhere. I'm from Austin. I'm from Charlotte. I'm from Jacksonville. I'm from Little Rock.
I don't know what that is, but basically what I'm saying is the people who love Simon here love him regardless. It doesn't matter that he lives in Massachusetts. It's not the only reason. If I lived in New Mexico, there would be 1,000 less people in New England that were Casey White fans. Yeah. Like, you know what I'm saying? And basically, I just kind of look around at everybody, and I know everybody in the crowd, but I'm the only one on the other side of the ropes. And it's just weird to me. Every single year, it's been Kyle Moriarty, newly Paul Kranz, Marky Chapp. You know, way back in the day, we had, like, Mike Dussault playing the MSDGC and Gerald and those guys. And, you know, come a 19-year history now. I believe 2004 was the first year, so that would make this the 20th.
20th year, according to the pamphlet that
so
I looked at
earlier. So the 20th year, and this is probably the first year that ever had one Massachusetts, like, born and bred player in the event.
While it's on my mind, there were more players with South Dakota as their listed registration for PDGA playing the Jonesboro Open than there were Arkansas players.
Wow. That's actually really funny.
So I guess it might be easier to distance yourself from score benchmarks at Maple Hill, because they're like, the shots you can take for granted are like hole 11 and 12, where it's a huge ass landing zone. You kind of just throw it hard and figure it out.
Yep.
Whereas there's like three or four total bunny holes on Fox Run.
Yep.
And if you're not getting those, like, that's a tailspin unto itself.
Yeah. 2, 6, 10. I mean, the other one that I would say would be like 12 now.
Yeah. You can understand how you're not getting it, but it better be a tap-in.
Yeah,
bar.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking a little bit more broadly about the direction of disc golf, you're nearly 10 years younger than me, I think.
Yep, 23.
And you're more than 10 years younger than me. So I jumped on tour feeling like if I didn't commit to that soon, the Pro Tour was going to prioritize only the players who were on tour.
Yep.
And I wouldn't have a chance to earn a tour card in the future. Like. Yep. If I hadn't started playing full time in 2022, I might not have earned a 23 tour card. If I didn't go on tour in 23, I wouldn't be playing the MVP Open.
Yep.
Do you feel like it's a net positive or net negative for the, like, overall culture of disc golf to have a Pro Tour that's pretty much walled off from having regional and local participants at some of the largest events?
That's a tough question, because, like, I think that just me would be the perfect example, because I am full-time tour. As much as I would do anything to stick around New England, play with my friends all the time, play all the local events, and, like, I miss out on so many local events every summer now, and I would do anything to do it, but I know what I have to do to make my sponsors happy, to feel fulfilled, you know, in my career and all that stuff, and that's to be on the full-time tour. And I might find myself in Texas saying I would way rather be anywhere but here. And that's just where the tour brings us, so you do what you're told.
And sometimes that's not so much about place as, like, where you are that week.
Yeah.
Like, come the next week, you feel great, even though you're still in Texas.
Exactly. And, like, I just feel like the regional players, it's really just because I think it was so cold turkey. It went from, if you can dog it, you can dog it, sign up, and you know, you might miss cash, but, like, the local players still got to play.
Yeah.
And it went to immediately restricted. If you're not somebody, you can't play your favorite event of the year anymore.
And it seems even more severe in this region because Maple Hill has 72 players.
Yeah.
Compare that to Las Vegas Challenge to start the year where, you know, it was still 140
And Las Vegas doesn't have a club, basically, compared to New England.
They do, but it's kind of like one little outpost in the desert where it's a two-hour drive to the next place.
Okay.
Certainly not as densely populated as all of New England.
Yes, and especially Worcester.
Right.
Like, Worcester is an incredibly populated disc golf hotspot for all of New England.
Yeah. Well, neither you nor I have the power to change that, and the Pro Tour is acting in its own self-interest, which, you know, as a business, it has to. I guess we'll both monitor it. I think we've both done enough to earn a tour card for 2024.
I believe so.
And, you know, maybe at this point, neither of us out of the running for the 2024 world title, tour points championship, etc.
Yep. One thing I do want to add, though, is you said, like, you decided to go full tour 2022. I just did it basically on a whim 2021, and it's literally just luckily perfect timing. Like, you know, a year later, and I might have been sorry for myself. And
well, the sun shines on a dog's ass and Casey White every now and again. Yeah. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can find me on Instagram and whatever the fuck Twitter is, at fish58320. And if you hated this podcast, you thought the guest was a total bozo, where can people find you, Casey?
You can find me on YouTube at Casey White Disc Golf, Instagram CaseyWhite4, and on the Disc Golf Pro Tour.
There you go. Do you have any merch or discs for sale to help support that?
I sure do. Discmania just released my first ever Signature Series disc, Horizon FD1 Skywalker. I think that if you haven't tried one, it just might be your new favorite disc. So you're going to have to see for yourself.
All right. There you go. Casey, thank you so much.
Of course.
That's all for this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast. But be sure to check out previous episodes and subscribe wherever fine podcasts are sold. Check out Fish Golf Broadcast hats and other apparel at discgolfbra.com and badger your friends until they listen too. Join us next time as I goad yet another guest into starting a fight with another touring player, campsite host, or toll booth attendant on the Fish Golf Broadcast.